Chapter 7.
So how do you make both shots count?
Sorsha mused as she stared at the car across the street. If we take out Peter, I think the rest'll slink away, I replied.
You're probably right. I get the sense that he's the only one that's really invested in this. The others all thought this was just going to be a quick fight, with them emerging victorious because there's so many more of them. The gun scares them.
And gives us the advantage, I added as I grabbed the Ruger 22 and slung it over my shoulder with the strap. They have no idea we only have 2 bullets left.
What are you going to do?
She asked as I stood up. Get Peter. I smirked as I climbed over the broken window pane and out the window. I heard muted exclamations as I dropped into the weeds, then started to walk across what was left of the yard. A head poked over the top of the car, but it wasn't Peter, so I simply pointed the Maverick without pulling the trigger. The head disappeared, and a more frantic discussion took place. I stopped at the crumbling curve and waited to see who would be brave enough to appear first. There was a squeal that reminded me of a mouse that's just been caught by an owl, and then a young woman who looked like she was little more than gray flesh stretched across a human skeleton darted from behind the car and ran down the street. If she hadn't been running, I would have sworn she was already dead and had been for some time. I was so startled at first, and then so horrified, that I watched her run off without even pointing either of the guns in her direction. While I tried to recover from the vision of the running dead woman, another young kid who could have been either male or female sprinted after her. The pair ran until they reached the next corner, then veered into one of the yards. They climbed gracelessly over a fence and disappeared from view, though I could still hear them as they ran through the debris. Another long discussion followed from behind the car, and finally, Peter risked a look. He only put his head up for a moment, but he still looked angry rather than afraid.
Fucking normals! Peter yelled. Anywhere else in the world and the mages would have killed your ass by now for having a gun! Is that why you're here? Did the mages send you to kill off the mutants?
I've got no argument with you, I replied calmly. I wouldn't have shot any of you if you'd let us leave quietly, like Danny asked.
Liar!
Peter shouted. And with that, Peter and a large, hairy man lunged over the top of the car. I had no idea what their strategy was, or if they even had one. Maybe they thought they could confuse me with 2 targets, but since they were both moving toward me along the same line, and I had the Mossberg in my hands and the Ruger within easy reach, that didn't really work. I took out the hairy man first, since he was by far the faster of the two. He was several steps ahead of Peter, but I was able to bring the Maverick up and fire when he was still halfway across the road. I was ready for the punch this time, and I kept the gun pointed at the hairy man despite the punch to my arm. I didn't even bother to watch him fall. As the Maverick vanished from my hand, I pulled the Ruger from my shoulder and pointed it at the mutant before he could even notice that his partner had gone down. The deafening boom of the Mossberg Maverick, followed almost immediately by the crack of the Ruger 22, was enough to send the last of the local wildlife still in the area scurrying for cover. A flock of pigeons took to the air, and a pair of squirrels bolted into a tree. I managed to register all of this, even as I saw the final bullet find its target. Peter seemed to fall in slow motion. The bullet from the 22 hit him in the middle of the chest, and I was a bit surprised when the top half of his body jerked backward while his legs were still moving forward. There was an awkward moment when the 2 halves pulled at each other, and then Peter levitated off the ground for a few tenths of a second. Gravity took over then, and Peter landed on his back on the pavement, a small hole in his chest, a river of blood pouring down his chin, and a pool of crimson spreading around his body. The Ruger was gone as well, but the other mutants either didn't notice or didn't care. One was brave enough to run over to the Catman and half-drag, half-carry him away, but the others took off without a backward glance. I watched the ragtag band follow the path taken by their peers and didn't move until the last sound of their departure had died away. Sorsha! I called out after the ringing in my ears subsided and the birds started to chirp again.
I'd say you made those last shots count,
she noted. I turned back toward the little house, but Sorsha had moved away from the window. I waited a moment, but the mage didn't appear at the door like I expected. Of course, she probably couldn't move the cabinet on her own. I chided myself, and I walked back toward the smashed window. I peered inside, but Sorsha wasn't inside, struggling with the cabinet. In fact, I couldn't see her anywhere. I climbed back over the windowsill much more carefully than I had when I had climbed out and looked around the little house. "Sorsha?" I called again.
"Down here,"
came the muffled response. I followed her voice to a tiny door in the kitchen. I spotted the skeleton Sorsha had mentioned, dressed in a faded flower print dress, and collapsed in front of an oven whose door was still open. The canine skeleton was on the floor near the back door, and the feline skeleton was curled up on a counter. I shook my head at the strange scene, then stuck my head inside the door. I could pick out Sorsha's measly frame in the dark depths of the cellar, though not much more than that. It sounded like she was trying to move something, but I couldn't see what exactly she was doing. I heard her sneeze, and then something clanked to the floor. "Sorsha!" I repeated as I looked at the steps that led to the cellar. "We should probably get going before those kids get back to the school and tell everyone what happened."
"Right, yes,"
came Sorsha's reply.
"But I think there's something down here that will help us move along a bit quicker."
I tested the first step, then moved cautiously down the rest. Sorsha was near the far wall where several boxes had been stacked. There was also a pile of children's toys and an old rocking chair. But Sorsha had found something of interest hanging from the wall, and I moved in closer to see what it was.
"Bicycles,"
Sorsha explained as I joined her. "But the tires will be flat," I commented. Bikes were still popular, especially around towns, but the tires were always a problem. The original ones required air, which meant a pump of some sort to keep them inflated. Bike owners usually scavenged their own, but they weren't always easy to find if you ventured too far from home. The other option was one of the new tires that didn't require air, but they tended to be hard on the rump and usually broke after a few short miles.
"That's what I thought,"
Sorsha said, as she moved the light so I could study the bikes.
"But the tires are still inflated. I'm not sure they even need air, but I don't know how that would be possible in pre-magic bicycles."
I felt a moment of panic as I considered the possibility that this was one of the homes that Danny had mentioned, where a mutant had taken up residence, and that the bikes were being maintained by a pair of mutants who wouldn't be happy to find us or the bodies in their house when they returned. But it was clear, even in the paltry light of the flame, that the bikes had been here for some time, and no one had been refilling the tires or riding them around the streets. "They don't look very big," I finally offered.
"They may be for children, but I think we can still ride them."
I shrugged and stepped forward with a sigh, since it was clear I was expected to retrieve the bikes. I managed to pull both bikes from the rack and set them on the floor of the cellar. It was hard to tell, but one looked like it was pink and the other was a pastel blue-green shade. Sorsha smiled and picked up the pink bike with both hands. The Irish woman seemed surprised at how light it was and gave a little laugh of approval. With a wink to me, she carried the bike over to the steps. After a pause to study the steps and consider her options, the mage started back upstairs with the bike held on one hip. I started to look around the old cellar, but the flickering light followed Sorsha rather than staying in this room full of pre-magic oddities. As soon as the mage stepped into the room upstairs, I was back in total darkness, and all the curiosities disappeared from view. I cursed at the sudden lack of light, then felt around for the second bike. I finally found the handlebars after a bit of blind fumbling, then managed to carry the bike to the steps without crushing anything underfoot. I made it up the stairs, slowly, and stepped into the kitchen with the second bike. I noticed that three of the cabinet drawers were open, and then I spotted Sorsha in the front room with a handful of old rags. I watched her for a moment as she wiped away the years of dust, then lugged the second bike into the room. "Well, you're right about the tires," I said as I dropped the second bike to the ground. The bike bounced once before it settled.
"It's amazing. Tires that don't go flat. How come there aren't more of them around?"
"Maybe someone's been hoarding them," I suggested with a grin. "Maybe there's an entire black market in inflated tires that we don't know about."
"After some of the things we've seen, I wouldn't be surprised."
"I don't think they're children's bikes," I said as I sat on the blue-green one for a moment and wiped away some dust and peered at the writing underneath. "But I think they're tall enough that we can use them for at least part of the way."
"I think so too,"
Sorsha agreed as she stood back to admire the pink bike. What a strange name for a bike, I mused, as I studied the bright red letters that had been revealed beneath 50 years of dust. A mongoose. Is that shorthand for a humongous goose?
It's an animal. I read a story when I was a child about a mongoose kept as a pet. It saved the family by killing a dangerous snake. My father told me that ancient people really did keep them as pets in some countries because they would fight and kill the most dangerous snakes in the world.
Why would you name a bike after one? Were they really fast?
The one in the story was,
Sorsha replied with a shrug.
They'd have to be to fight a snake.
Huh, I murmured as I tried to picture what type of animal would hunt snakes. I'd seen raptors grab snakes before, of course, and even watched a black bear catch a rattler. But most animals shied away from snakes unless they were really hungry or really desperate.
Oh, and I found these on a shelf near the door,
the Irish woman suddenly blurted out as she reached inside her pocket. She handed me a silver cardboard box that still had traces of ink on the cover. Something inside clinked when she placed it in my palm, and I carefully opened it. Bullets! I yelled in surprise.
I thought you'd be happy.
Wow, 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 wow! What a great find! It was hard to contain the excitement I felt, and I nearly dumped the collection onto the floor when I shot to my feet from the pure joy of it. I quickly wrapped the box in both hands, took a deep breath to steady myself, then sat down on the bike again and studied the treasure more carefully.
I think they go with the gun I found, since it was near the spot where I found it. We could take it with us now that we have bullets.
Absolutely, I agreed as I carefully picked up each bullet one at a time and studied it. The bullets reminded me of the flying machines at the airport in a way. They were long, smooth cylinders, just like those old machines, but with a flat top at both ends rather than a curved nose. There was a bright band of red plastic wrapped around about 3/4 of the bullet's length that was then folded over one of the ends. The end with the plastic had what looked like a child's picture of a sun carved into it, while the metal end had the word Winchester and 12GA stamped into it. Grooves had been cut into the plastic that covered the bullet's length, and the words Super X, or maybe it was supposed to be read X Super, had been stamped on top. Beneath that, I could just make out a 2 followed by 2 zeros, and then the phrase 9 pellets. It looked like there was supposed to be something between the 2 and the zeros, but that part had faded away on the bullet that I was studying. What do you suppose 9 pellets means? I asked aloud.
Maybe there are 9 pellets inside,
Sorsha suggested as she ran a rag over the seat to the pink bike.
We could cut one open and see.
No, I said quickly. We can't afford to waste any. Maybe there'll be an explanation in that book that Evan gave me.
Does it give you any clues on the box?
She asked. I put the bullet back in the box and closed the lid. I carefully wiped the lid clean, but the only thing it had was a picture of a man on a horse next to the letter R in a circle, the name Winchester, and a plea to keep safety first while enjoying our sport. There was also a picture of an impressive stag, a repeat of the information that had been stamped onto the plastic, and the phrase buckshot, unplated shot. I think these are called shot rather than bullets, I announced.
Shot,
Sorsha repeated as she wiped a rag over the bike that I still sat on. Or maybe buckshot, I amended.
Why buckshot instead of bullets? Because it's a different type of gun?
I don't know. I shrugged and resumed my examination of the box. One side repeated the names Winchester and Super X, along with a string of numbers and a long group of words. The only part I could make any sense out of was the phrase, made in USA. The rest of it appeared to be nonsense, and certainly didn't offer any help on how to load the shot into the Mossberg Maverick. The other side of the box carried a warning, one in English and one in a language that might have been French or maybe Spanish. It didn't really matter because the English version was scary enough. I was advised, in capital letters, not to use the ammunition in Damascus or twist barrels to start. And I peered at the Maverick for a moment to see if it had a twisted barrel. What does Damascus mean? I asked, after I reaffirmed that the Maverick's barrel was straight.
It's a city,
Sorsha replied. Are you sure?
Has been for thousands of years.
Huh. Did they make really bad stuff?
What do you mean?
She stopped dusting long enough to ask me. It says you can't use these in a Damascus barrel. I thought that might be because the barrels from Damascus weren't well made or something.
Well, I've never heard that said about Damascus, but since the previous owner bought the gun and the bullets, I mean shots, I assume it should be okay to use them.
It was a valid argument, especially since I had no idea how to tell if the barrel had been made in Damascus. I decided Sorsha was right, and so I turned back to the rest of the warning, which continued on with several other guidelines. I needed to remove excess lubricant, avoid the breech if the gun failed to fire, wear shooting glasses and hearing protection, and point the gun in a safe direction at all times. I sighed and shook my head. I had no idea where the breech was, and I certainly didn't have shooting glasses or hearing protection. Maybe I could stuff some cotton into my ears, but then how would I know if someone came up behind me? I was only halfway through the warning, and I was already disgruntled by what I'd read. Next, I was told not to shoot at hard surfaces or water, to prevent ricochet. That almost sounded fun, but maybe only when no one else was around. The next part of the warning was less enjoyable, though, with dire predictions about birth defects, reproductive harm, and other serious physical injury. It was enough to make me want to drop the box and forget the whole thing, though all of those problems could apparently be relieved by having adequate ventilation and washing one's hands. It was the most confusing warning I'd ever read, and at the end, I had no idea if it was safe to tote the box around with us or not. I opened the lid again, then counted how many buckshots were in the box. 16 in total, one more than was promised on the lid. Since the gun only held 2 shots at a time, I could load the gun 8 times before it would become useless. Given our present rate of bullet consumption, though, that wouldn't be all that long. Still, it was another weapon at our disposal, and I was happy to have it, no matter how dire the warning on the box had been.
"Do you know how to use them?"
the mage asked as she finally stopped wiping down the blue bike. "I'm sure I could figure it out," I replied with more confidence than I actually had. A smile tugged at the corners of my mouth, though, and I felt like the guy who had just discovered some long, hidden treasure chest full of gems and gold coins. Sorsha mused with a wry smile. The mage winked at me as she took a seat on the pink bike and pedaled it in a tight circle around the front room. Apparently satisfied with the bike's condition, the Irishwoman pedaled to the front door and studied the cabinet we'd moved.
"Hex, are you coming?"
she teased. I placed the box of buckshots in my satchel, then pushed the blue bike toward the front door. I spotted the original Maverick on an end table and scooped it up as well. I took a moment to savor the feel of it in my palm, then tucked it into the satchel with the box of buckshots. I took one last look around the room, then moved toward the cabinet. Sorsha hopped off the pink bike when I signaled to her and set it against the wall. On the count of 3, we pushed the cabinet back into its original position as yet more pieces of china tumbled over. With our exit cleared, we opened the battered door and pushed the bikes outside. I had only ridden a bike a few times when I was a kid. My foster brothers, Peter and Preston, had each received one as a birthday present 1 year. They had begged their father, Paul Reese, for the bikes, and he had sent one of the hands 3 towns over to buy them each one. I hadn't actually been allowed on one until Peter and Preston had become bored with the bike. I myself hadn't seen the appeal, but then I was riding horses every day by then, so the bikes had quietly disappeared into the barn where the Reese daughters would sometimes ride them. All of this is a short way of explaining that I was not a very good bike rider. It took a few near spills before I found my balance, and then I tended to wobble all over the road as I rode from one curb to the other. Sorsha, naturally, knew exactly what she was doing. She pedaled effortlessly along the road and neatly avoided all the holes and rubble that littered my path. She would power on ahead, then stop and wait for me to catch up. When she was sure that I was still on the bike and still pedaling like crazy, she would set off again with a happy smile and a sly wink in my direction. What I really wanted at that moment was a good horse, but we hadn't seen a single equine since we'd entered the wasteland, not even a wild one. So I pedaled on and hoped we were on the right road that would take us to Short Hills and the portal mage named Vance. I'd admit that the bike saved us time. There was still a trace of sunlight in the sky when I found Sorsha waiting for me next to a sign that said, Welcome to the Mall at Short Hills. Beyond that stood a massive complex that occupied several acres of land and still managed to look shiny and new, despite the fact that it had been abandoned for 50 years. It's huge, I gawked as I studied the mall. How are we supposed to find one portal mage in there?
Doesn't look like anyone is living there. Maybe he's the only one in there.
I don't think that'll make it any easier, I replied. We pedaled our bikes along the entrance road toward what looked like one of the main entrances. Letters over the door spelled out the name Neiman Marcus, and just across from that stood an open, multi-story structure that still had a few cars parked inside. A building just for parking cars? I laughed as I peered at the odd structure. Can you believe someone would have a building just for parking cars?
They did have a lot of cars. I guess it makes sense. And people build barns for their animals.
Yeah, but nothing this big, I pointed out.
Well, but look at the size of the mall. They must have had thousands of people here every day.
I shrugged and turned my attention back to the store called Neiman Marcus. The glass in one of the doors was long gone, and it was easy enough to push our way inside. We left the bikes propped against a display cabinet just inside the door and started to wander aimlessly around the store. As interested as I was in the pre-magic world, I grew impatient as Sorsha discovered an entire section devoted to women's clothing. She picked through the seemingly endless racks, even though most of the clothes smelled musty and had holes. My lover seemed determined to find the one decent shirt in the entire store, and I eventually gave up and wandered toward some glass display cases instead. The glass in the cases had long since been shattered and most of the items removed, but there were still a few bits and pieces of jewelry floating among the shards of glass. I found a delicate necklace tucked into a corner that featured a black stone striped with blue light. The streaks of blue seemed to shift and change color as I turned the stone around to different angles, and I wondered if this was some man-made material or something natural.
What did you find?
Sorsha asked when she found me. I smiled at her when I saw the straw hat she had on her head and the shirts and pants she had draped over her arm. I held up the necklace for her inspection, and I saw her eyes light up.
An opal! I haven't seen one in ages!
I was trying to decide if it was some sort of pre-magic material, I said as I handed the necklace to her.
No, they're natural,
she said as she set down her armload of clothes and accepted the necklace.
But they're hard to find now. They're only found in a few places, and black ones like this are even rarer.
Well, I don't think anyone's going to complain if you take it, I pointed out. Sorsha looked around guiltily for a moment, then slipped the necklace around her neck. She turned toward me once she figured out how to work the clasp and gave me a quizzical look. It's almost as beautiful as you, I remarked. Sorsha smiled and scooped up the clothes she had found. She managed to carry the load in one arm while she slipped her other hand under my arm. We finally left Neiman Marcus then and ventured into the rest of the mall, though there was very little light to see by. Sorsha created a small, flickering light that followed us like an obedient dog while we strolled past a bit of history. It was a two-story structure without any windows, yet the last of the sunlight filtered in from square holes in the roof. A few still had glass, but most of the panels had fallen to the floor below to join the leaves and dirt that now covered the tiles. A few plants had managed to sneak in as well and wound around the banisters on staircases or hung from the signs over the doors. Wrens darted around the mall, and somewhere I heard the familiar call of a barn owl.
What did they sell in all these places?
Sorsha asked as we strolled past a place called Cartier. Pretty much anything you can imagine, I replied, though I wasn't entirely sure myself.
I wonder what kind of place would appeal to Vance,
Sorsha mused as she scanned the endless line of stores. Maybe someplace with furniture, I suggested as I spotted a store filled with chairs and tables.
Ooh!
Sorsha suddenly gasped. She dropped my arm and darted ahead, intent on whatever she had seen. Her wobbly flame followed after her like a fly on a string, and I suddenly found myself alone in the dark. I glanced around at the silent stores, then followed the mage's path more carefully. I found her in a bookstore where she was perusing the shelves. Most of the books appeared to be little more than moldy mush, but a few near the back had survived almost intact. There were signs over different groups of shelves that seemed to identify the types of books, and Sorsha was between a line of shelves, one labeled Mystery and one labeled Romance. "You do know we can't carry around all this stuff with us," I pointed out as I joined her.
"I know,"
she sighed as she looked at the books on the shelves.
"But I thought it might be fun to have one or two that we could read at night."
"Maybe get one of the smaller ones," I suggested as I pointed towards some with paper covers like the Atlas. "They'll be easier to carry." Sorsha nodded and started to examine the smaller books. After a few moments, she chose two from the mystery section and two from the romance section.
"I could probably trade these after I've read them,"
she noted as she tucked her selections into her satchel. "And what about all those clothes you've been carrying around?" I teased.
"I'm going to try them on and see what I like,"
she replied defensively. "Well, in the meantime, we should probably find a place to rest for the night and maybe have a bite to eat," I remarked as I thought back to the place with the chairs and tables.
"Let's see what other stores there are. Maybe we'll find one that's really fun."
Maybe, I sighed as I thought about a pair of really comfortable-looking chairs that had been front and center at the chair and table place. Sorsha pulled me back into the mall, and we wandered around some more. We ventured up and down the stairs and stood inside a glass elevator, though we couldn't see what was so exciting about staring out at the mall from inside a glass box. We pushed the buttons as well, but nothing happened. So we gave up on the elevator and moved on to the next section of stores. "Okay, that's the place we have to stay tonight," I declared as I pointed to a store on the other side of the second-floor walkway.
"Casper?"
Sorsha queried as she squinted at the store. "Look what they sell," I said as I looked for the shortest way to get across.
"Oh,"
Sorsha replied as she finally registered what was on display in the window. We had to circle around past a store called Loomingdale's, but we were soon standing outside the Casper store where rows of beds beckoned to us.
"Wow,"
was all Sorsha said as she stopped just inside the door and looked around. "Let's pick one," I suggested, as I flopped onto one of the beds.
"Look at that one,"
Sorsha mused as she walked past me.
"I've never seen a bed that was raised up like that before. But why is only one side raised? The other one's still flat."
"Who knows," I replied from my new favorite spot. "We don't have to sleep on it, so why worry about it?" I closed my eyes and let myself enjoy the luxury of a well-made mattress. It was soft, but still supportive, and I felt like I was nesting rather than merely sleeping. I could hear Sorsha as she moved around the store, but I was too tired and too comfortable to get up and follow her around as she investigated the rest of the options. I heard her stop by my bed a few minutes later, and I opened one eye to the glorious sight of the beautiful Irish woman looking at me.
"There's a bigger bed at the back. Plenty of room to have some fun in."
"Oh, but this one is very comfortable," I declared as I patted the mattress.
"Yes, but you've already put your dirty boots up on it. And the one in the back still has sheets and pillows on it."
"Well, I guess I could try it," I smirked as I rolled off the mattress. Sorsha led me toward the back of the store and the bed she'd picked out. The sheets were a pale blue and threadbare after all the years of exposure, but the mattress was wide and inviting and the pillows still looked plump. Sorsha had dropped her armload of clothes and satchels on a nearby bed, and she soon added her hat, boots, and the rest of her clothes. She turned around and let me soak in the vision of her body, with only the portal necklace and the opal necklace around her neck, before she slipped quietly onto the bed and gave me a come-hither smile. I stripped off my own boots and clothes at that point and jumped into the bed. I felt the tremor of excitement that moved up the mage's spine as she grabbed my hand and pulled me closer. I grinned at her, then started to climb on top once again.
"Wait,"
she said as she ran her hand slowly across my chest.
"Let me start on top this time."
"Oh, a lady who knows what she wants," I teased as I rolled onto my back.
"You don't know the half of it,"
she replied with a saucy grin as she sprawled across my chest. She straddled me as she sat up and started to trace her fingers along my chest, then down toward my groin. I could feel the tendrils of her power snake along my nerves wherever she touched me, and I groaned in anticipation.
"Patience,"
she chuckled as her hand found my shaft and started to rub. "No promises," I retorted as she found a rhythm that she liked. She grinned again, then she dipped her head, and all I could see was the river of her gold hair. I could feel her tongue, though, as it carved a path down my groin and toward my penis, where her hand still worked its own bit of magic. The pressure that started to build inside me became an ache that I couldn't release, and I heard myself moan desperately as her tongue finally found my shaft. I grabbed a handful of her hair with one hand and started to massage her scalp in time with her strokes. I felt her knock her head against my hand like a cat looking for someone to pet its chin, so I moved my hand toward the side of her head, then slowly started to stroke along the nape of her neck. My erection was at full attention when she eased herself up for a moment, and I thought I would burst when the feel of her hand and tongue disappeared. She looked at me from beneath a curtain of gold, then slowly licked her lips.
"Are you ready?"
she asked. "Oh, hell yes," I declared. She laughed for a moment as she swept the hair away from her face. Then she sat up again and gave me a perfect view of her breasts. As I admired the perfect curves of her body, she went to her knees, arched her back, and guided me inside her.
"Oh, perfect."
She closed her eyes as my erection penetrated her pussy, but she was already hot and very wet, and the scent of peach and apricot and something that reminded me of jasmine in summer started to fill the store.
"Ride me like you want to," I moaned.
"Yes."
She rolled her hips as she found the spot she wanted, then placed her hands on my chest. She started to rock on my shaft, sometimes fast, sometimes slow, but always with just enough pressure to provide us both with a wave of pleasure. I helped support her with a hand on her waist, which she took full advantage of. She started to roll into different spots just to see how far she could go. Whenever she was close enough, I would grab one of her breasts with my other hand. They were firm beneath my hand, and she would moan whenever I ran my thumb across their nipples. And then I felt the pulse inside her, and I knew she was close. She started to rock harder and faster, and I could have sworn her teeth chattered. But then I was swept up in her own rising heat as she opened the link between us, and all I could feel was my erection as it pounded into her, as well as her sheer bliss as she rode me harder and harder. We climaxed together, so perfectly timed that I was convinced we were both about to explode from the heat and pressure. She heaved as my seed poured into her, but she kept herself firmly planted on top of me, and held my rod in place while she soaked up every last drop of me. It felt like an eternity before I could finally see something besides flashes of gold and twinkling stars, but the tension in my body finally started to ease, and I could feel the cool sheet beneath my back once again. I realized I was still squinting, and that the panting noise I heard was probably me, so I forced myself to take a couple of deep breaths and then open my eyes all the way. Sorsha was still on top of me with her head on my shoulder and her arms draped across mine. She felt so light that I couldn't believe she had just had the power to drive me the way she had.
"You're wonderful," I whispered as I ran a hand through her hair again.
She looked up and gave me a languorous smile. A moment later, she locked her lips around mine, and all I could taste were the sweet flavors of honey and peach.
"You're wonderful, too,"
she said when she finally came up for air. "Will you let me prove it?" I asked as I started to tease her nipples.
"So soon?"
"I wouldn't want to leave you high and dry," I responded. Her laugh became a groan, and as I started to run my fingers down her spine, she quivered under my caressing. When her whole body started to shake, I rolled her onto her back and stuck a finger inside her tunnel. She was still moist inside, and she writhed as I found one of her favorite spots. She spread her legs apart and her eyes rolled back as she tried to grind herself against me.
"Hex,"
she hissed as she tried to pull me closer. "Hold on," I told her as I started to kiss and lick along her breasts. My own erection was hard again, and the friction of our two bodies rubbing together nearly drove me crazy. But I wanted to make it last as long as I could, so I focused on the hard, round tits beneath my tongue.
I could taste the salt on her skin, and something earthy but not musky. It reminded me of a clear day on a high mountain ridge, bright and clean and simple, yet more delicious than most exotic flavors. I kept her going for so long that her skin had flushed a dark pink before I finally penetrated her again. She was more than ready to welcome me inside, and she pressed against me as hard as she could as I started to move in and out. I went slowly at first and made sure to find her favorite spots, but the pressure in the air around us became unbearable, and I picked up the pace once I'd hit every zone at least once. The link between us expanded the longer I stayed inside her, and soon it was hard to tell where I ended and where she began. It was just one large, glowing arena of euphoric sex, and if we could have managed it, we would have stayed locked together like that for the rest of the night. But I did eventually release inside of her again, slowly and after several more blissful moments. When we finally collapsed onto the bed for the last time, Sorsha snuggled against me and fell asleep almost instantly. I managed to stay awake for a bit longer, but the sex had worn me out in the way nothing else could, and I soon fell into a dreamless sleep. I awoke a few hours later, still drowsy and momentarily disoriented. I had a flashback to Sorsha's glorious body poised over mine, and grinned at the memory. The blonde mage was still curled beside me, and I started to lean over her for a quick kiss when I froze and looked toward the front of the store. It was still dim in the mall, even though the sun had to be up. I peered into the darkness and tried to figure out what had caught my attention, and then I realized I had heard something rather than seen something. That something was a human voice that sang snippets from various songs as it moved along the walkway near our hiding spot, and the voice was getting closer to the bed store with every off-key lyric it sang.